University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers to the campus to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Dr. Thomas E. Cronin, an author and member of the faculty at Colorado College in Colorado Springs, and the annual Dwight P. Griswold Lecture, Reflections on the Clinton Presidency. In addition to serving as McHugh Professor of American Institutions at Colorado College, Cronin is the author, co-author, or editor of 12 books, including The State of the Presidency, Government by the People, and Direct Democracy, The Politics of the Initiative, Referendum, and Recall. He has lectured in 49 states and at more than 300 colleges and universities in the United States and around the world. Cronin is a past recipient of the American Political Science Association's Charles E. Merriam Award for significant contributions to the art of government. Cronin is a contributing columnist for the Christian Science Monitor, and his essays have appeared in a range of scholarly and popular magazines, including the New York Times Magazine and TV Guide. He has appeared as a guest political analyst on The Today Show, Nightline, The McNeil Era News Hour, C-SPAN, CNN, ABC, CBS, and NBC. Cronin's public service experience includes working for a year as a White House aide, running for Congress in 1982, and serving an internship in the United States Senate. Join us now for University Forum and Dr. Thomas Cronin.
Thank you very much, John. It's a great pleasure to be at your well-known university, Nebraska Wesleyan. John's introduction of me warrants a short response. He gave me a very glowing introduction, said some very nice things. One should always be a little bit suspicious, however, about introductions. Let me tell you about my favorite story about a political leader being introduced one time. William Howard Taft was President of the United States. Very large man. Some people joke that the Oval Office was designed in his honor. He was about 330 pounds on a good day. He also was Supreme Court Chief Justice. And he was being introduced at a dinner in New York one time by the senior senator from New York, Senator Chauncey Depew. And Chauncey Depew gave the Chief Justice and former President of the United States a 20-minute introduction, and it concluded with the following peroration. He says, "Ladies and gentlemen, in a few moments I shall introduce to you a man who is pregnant with integrity, a man who is pregnant with virtue, a man who is pregnant with wisdom." And that went on for a few more minutes. Finally, he came to that old shop-worn cliche, and now, without further ado, as the crowd sighed with relief, I will present to you our featured guest, the former President of the United States and the current Chief Justice of the United States of America, William Howard Taft. Taft, to his credit, came up to the lectern, onto the podium, composed all of himself, looked at his audience, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, if it is a boy, I shall name him Wisdom. If it is a girl, I shall name her Virtue. But if, as I suspect, it is merely gas, I shall name it Senator Chauncey Depew." Who, of course, was the man who introduced him. So, John, thank you very much for that kind introduction. It is my assignment here at the Dwight P. Griswold Annual Lecture to share some thoughts about how our saxophone-playing, McDonald's food, junk-eating, pot-smoking, baby boomer, draft-dodging Rhodes Scholar, husband of Hillary, father of Chelsea, friend of Jennifer's, is doing as our 42nd President of the United States. He's only been there slightly over a month, and this is a premature analysis. The short answer to how is he doing is he's been off to a rough start, particularly in his transition, particularly in his first 2-3 weeks. His triumph so far, plainly, was a week ago Wednesday night when he spoke to the Congress and to the nation about an economic program for the future, a deficit reduction, spending cut, tax increase program that he believes is necessary for the nation. And he seized the higher ground by putting the central issues on the table, the issues that were central to the 1992 campaign. He has 47 months, or nearly 47 months left in his first term. The people at Georgetown University, I'm told, say that he's really in Washington serving his second four-year term. His first four-year term he spent in the 1960s at Georgetown as an undergraduate. So he's, in some respects, there for a second term. But it is his first term as president, and he has got a long way to go. It's very early to say how he's going to do. I think he has the potential for being an excellent president. He also has a good chance, or maybe an excellent chance, of being like a Gerry Ford or a Jimmy Carter, with the events and the Congress and interest groups overwhelming him. So a lot remains to be seen. Certainly his transition and his first 2 or 3 weeks in the White House left a lot to be desired and would really normally be graded at the C or B minus level. I'm a little bit reminded of one of his friends who describes the Clinton jogging style as follows, and it applies perhaps to his transition in early days in the White House. His friend said, the way Clinton jogs is that he starts off slowly and then he tapers off. And think about that. He starts off slowly, then he tapers off. Well, that's a little bit how he got such a very slow start in the beginning of this presidential period. Let's jump back for a moment to a year ago in the 1992 presidential primaries and caucus season. Just a year ago now, New Hampshire, Iowa, and the southern states and Super Tuesday were holding the selection process of who would become delegates to the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. It was by no means clear who was going to win the presidency. Just 6 months earlier, 8 months earlier, George Bush had enjoyed public opinion support that was unprecedented in recent times. His public opinion support was nearly 90-91%. This was right after his success in the Persian Gulf, Operation Desert Storm, when he and UN countries and our military succeeded in liberating Kuwait from the forces of Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi nation. It was a great triumph for George Bush. It was what he was good at. However, in the next 7 to 10 months, George Bush failed to convert that high popularity and the end of the Cold War and the success in the Persian Gulf into a affirmative, positive program at home that dealt with a growing yearning by the American people of all political persuasions that we needed to tend to our own economy and job stimulus and economic growth and the lumpy economic performance and the less and less competitive economy that we had in the larger global arena. George Bush sat on his popularity, sat on his hands, and he invited opposition not only from the Democrats and the press, but from his own party. Patrick Buchanan ran against him, announcing in late 1991 that he would challenge him for the Republican nomination. Patrick Buchanan had no qualifications for the American presidency. He was a pundit and a commentator, had never held political office, had never had executive responsibilities, had never been in business. No qualifications whatsoever, in my judgment. And yet he was able to pick off in New Hampshire and Florida and many of the early primaries and caucuses often as much as a third of the constituency among the activist Republicans who showed up in primaries and caucuses. It was a damaging blow to George Bush, and it was a first indication of the vulnerability of Bush. Just a few months earlier, all of the first string of the Democratic Party potential candidates for the American presidency pulled out of the presidential race. Mario Cuomo, Bill Bradley from New Jersey, Sam Nunn of Georgia, Al Gore of Tennessee, Lloyd Benson of Texas, and the list is longer, all decided in early 1991 or spring of 1991 that George Bush was too popular and that the Reagan-Bush years would be extended for another 4 years. Absolutely fascinating. So you had people like Tom Harkin and your senator, Bob Kerry, who, by the way, emerged as kind of the favorite in the pack for a while, as a kind of the second team, but kind of the leader of it, Jerry Brown, and Governor Clinton of Arkansas. 1% of the national population lives in Arkansas. He was known by governors, he was known by a lot of political activists in the hierarchy of the Democratic Party, but he wasn't known by you and your neighbors and your relatives, by and large. Bill Clinton of Arkansas, been governor for 12 years, Rhodes Scholar, but still wasn't very well known. He took a risk. He'd been governor so long, he was tiring of that, and he gave it a shot. He knew, too, that the fact that the A-team was not running made his chances better, and particularly because Southerners and his friends included in something called the Democratic Leadership Council a few years earlier had invented in 1985 the Super Tuesday, where a whole bunch of Southern states from Florida to Texas all made their decisions about delegates only 2 short weeks after the New Hampshire primary. That gave a Southerner, a moderate Democrat Southerner, a greater chance of winning a huge bunch of delegates, and he thought he might capitalize on that in a way that Al Gore had failed to capitalize on that 4 years earlier because Jesse Jackson was in the race that year, and Jesse Jackson siphoned off most of the black Democratic South vote in that Super Tuesday primary. So Bill Clinton jumped in. He had nothing to lose, really. But nobody gave him great chances of winning, really. It was really an unknown pack of Democrats versus George Bush, the incumbent. But Buchanan hurt Bush enormously. And then as soon as Bush finally kind of pushed Buchanan to the side, Bush had to face Ross Perot. I'm all ears. Ross Perot. He was listening to the American people. The American people were dissatisfied with George Bush. They were dissatisfied with the fact that we weren't really rapidly moving from a Cold War conversion plan, from winning the Cold War to addressing domestic needs. And Perot, to his credit, became the agenda setter for 1992. He was the one who did listen. It's ironic that you had a $3 billion listener and did a lot of talking, but the fact is he kind of sensed and became an agent for a lot of the disquietude and dissatisfaction in both the Democratic and Republican parties, as well as among a lot of grassroots people who don't regularly get involved in either political party. He was essentially a Republican, and he hurt George Bush even more than Buchanan. If you look at the period when he came in the spring of 1992 and waged political warfare on the incumbent president of the United States, George Bush and his people panicked. This guy was wealthy, this guy was threatening, and this guy had a message. And this guy was not allergic to vision, as was Mr. Bush. And that made a lot of difference. Perot captured the fancy of a lot of Americans, sometimes as many as a third of the American population across political parties in the spring and early summer of 1992. And he was essentially a Republican and making inroads on George Bush and Ronald Reagan's home base. That was tough. That was the second campaign in 1992 that George Bush had to face, even before the fall campaign where he'd have to face the Democratic ticket and the general election. And he would also, as it turns out, have to face Ross Perot all over again after Ross Perot took a summer vacation from July 16th to a little bit after Labor Day. So very important to remember here is that George Bush essentially had three presidential campaigns, one against Buchanan in the Democratic, in the Republican trenches, one against Perot, both in and outside of his party, and one against the ticket of Clinton and Gore in the September-October season. George Bush, it can be said, I think it can be fairly said by a thoughtful analyst of any either political party, George Bush, in many respects, had the best political resume of any candidate for the presidency in the 20th century. His resume, his vita, was terrific. He had been a war hero at age 19 in the Pacific as a fighter pilot for America in World War II. He'd graduated from top schools in the country. He came back. He went into business. And although he had some financial assistance from his family, the reality is he became a successful Texas oil entrepreneur. He was a Republican Party leader in Houston. He ran for office a few times. He was successful in getting elected to the United States House of Representatives. He served on the most important committee in the Congress, the House Ways and Means Committee. He later ran for the Senate and lost, but was rewarded by Richard Nixon to be the ambassador to the United Nations. He became the ambassador to China. He became the CIA director. He became the Republican national chairman right after the Watergate crisis that plagued the Republican Party. He ran for the presidency, lost out narrowly to Ronald Reagan in the primary seasons that year, 1980, became vice president, and became a very active vice president. Traveled all around the world. That's an impressive political resume. I defy you to come up with other 20th century candidates for the presidency who really match that. That's impressive. The problem George Bush ran up against, however, in 1992, was that resumes, experience, and being there meaning being in Washington, was not an asset in 1992. Because the Buchanans, the Perots, the Jerry Browns, the Tsongases, and the others ran against Washington, D.C. as if it was a plagued place, a diseased place, a place that didn't understand the voice of America, the yearnings of America, the dreams of Americans. I'll tell you my favorite political story of 1992, and it's a metaphor for this anger, hostility, skepticism, and questioning of those in office and those with fancy resumes. The story goes like this. It could be told, I should warn you, it's an apocryphal story, like all good stories. But it has a ring of great insight to it, so I tell it nonetheless. It could be told of a whole series of people. I'm going to tell it about Senator Bill Bradley, just for purposes of illustration. Senator Bill Bradley, most of you know who Senator Bill Bradley is? Students? More or less? I'll explain as I go along. Senator Bill Bradley is going to be the featured speaker at a huge dinner in New Jersey or New York or somewhere. There are 800 or 1,000 people gathered together, big dinner. He's up at the head table. He's eating dinner, still a half hour away or so, or an hour away before his talk. A waiter comes by, and the waiter says, he drops off one pat of butter on the senator's roll plate. And the senator looks at this waiter, and he says, "Hey, Mac, I'd like two," meaning two pats of butter. And the waiter responds, "Sorry, sir. One to a customer, hotel rules." Senator's a little annoyed by this, and he says, "Hey, Mac, perhaps you don't know who I am." And the waiter allows that that's the case. "Yes, sir, I'm sorry, I don't know who you are." And the senator then, striving to be polite, says in a quiet voice, "Well, I'm Senator Bill Bradley from New Jersey. I'm a graduate of Princeton University, Oxford University. I'm a former Rhodes Scholar. I'm a United States Senator. I'm the author of a lot of important legislation and taxes and so on. I also was an All-American Final Four All-Star for Princeton's basketball program. I was a New York Knickerbockers and NBA basketball player for 11 years with the Knicks. And I'm the speaker tonight at this dinner. I'm the featured speaker. The waiter takes all this in. Obviously, the waiter is very busy and has to get on with his business of passing out these warm pieces of butter to everybody. But the waiter is polite. It's the head table, after all, and so on. The waiter decides to respond the following way. He says, sorry, Senator, I didn't know who you were. But, Senator, with all due respect, you may not know who I am. Perhaps you don't know who I am. The senator, by this time, is fit to be tied, hard to contain his... All he wants is another damn piece of butter, right? A wonderful final exchange occurs. The senator says to the waiter, "You're right. I guess I don't know who you are." And then, the wonderful final line of this story, the waiter says, "Well, Senator, I'm the guy in charge of the butter." And that, my friends at Nebraska Wesleyan, is what the American voter was saying. They said that to a large number of Congress people, many of whom chose to retire before getting defeated. We sent back a whole 120 or so new members of the United States Congress, largest new blood in Congress in a long, long time. We defeated a president who had won 54% of the vote 4 years earlier in 1988. 54% of the vote, and he had won 40 out of 50 states in the Electoral College makeup of the election of 1988. In 1992, a mere 4 years later, 62% of the American people voted against him. 62% of the American people voted against him. And the there's no ringing mandate for Bill Clinton, but there is a ringing rebuke and rejection of George Bush. Just to remind you, Clinton won 44% of the vote, George Bush something on the order of 37, and Poirot won about 19% of the vote. I would contend and offer you or submit to you an explanation that by and large this election was a defeat and loss by President Bush rather than a victory and a win on behalf of the programs in particular, or the platform of the Democrats and Bill Clinton. There's an aphorism in political science, which will be on your exams in political science, I'm sure, later this year, those of you who are in political science courses, that most of the time, most voters vote retrospectively rather than prospectively, which is to say that they vote on the basis of what they've known during the past couple of years, the economy and what's gone on, and their confidence in the economy and the government and leaders, more than they're voting on behalf of what might come under an alternative candidate. And there's a great deal of logic to that. A great deal of logic to that because it is very hard to know what Poirot or what Clinton or what the Democrats are going to do once they get in there. It's much easier to know what has been the case than what might be the case under a new team and so on. And so, in most respects, and I'll wrap this up quickly on talking about the election and move to Clinton and his performance directly. In most respects, in 1992, we saw the rejection of a president. It was a referendum on George Bush and his handling of the economy. It was a referendum on jobs. It was a referendum on the future of economic opportunity in America. And on those grounds, the American voters, 62% of them, said no to George Bush. It was also, I think, the end of a 12-year run by the Republican Party. It is very difficult for a political party to stay in office for more than 8 or 12 years. You have to have a lot going for you. And the economy has to be good, and people have to be optimistic, and so on. The economy in 1992 was one of the worst years in terms of people's feelings about it, and unemployment and other indicators, particularly in states like New Jersey, New England, and California. It was in much, much tougher straits than many of the states in our region of the country. And one has to remember, too, in the past 15 years, what were the two best economic performing years? Well, the answer, rather quickly to my own question, is 1988 was the number one economic performing year, and 1988 was the second best performing year in the past 12 or 15 years. What happened in 1984, what happened in 1988, the Republicans won by 59 and 54% respectively, and smashing successes in the Electoral College in those years. In 1992, the opposite was the case, and that party went down to defeat. In American history, since we've had a two-party system, of a mass-based party with national conventions and so on, there have only been, I think, two occasions when parties have stayed in for more than for something like a 20-year run. And they usually had unusual circumstances, like after the Civil War for a run of Republicans, or during the Depression and World War II when Franklin Roosevelt kept getting elected and elected and elected, and then his deputy Truman got elected yet one more time. In a narrow election in 1948. We have a cyclical alternating pattern in American politics, and I think 1992 was part of that. But what about, but I'd say one last thing about the victory by Clinton. I think Perot was a great agent on behalf of Clinton. Perot was tougher on Bush's failure as an economic leader than was Clinton. So it made Clinton seem more plausible, more reasonable, and gave legitimacy to the skepticism and criticism of the White House. It was Perot who said we should have industrial policy. It was Perot who said the Cold War is over and those guys don't know it. It was Perot who said we are losing jobs and jobs, and we're getting taken to the cleaners by other nations, the Pacific Rim, and even in locally with these agreements with Mexico and so on. He dramatized this time and again. He had an uncanny way of talking, a little bit like Mark Twain, Will Rogers, and Huey Long all rolled up into one. And he was captivating. He showed that you could go on and talk issues. You could talk up to the American people. Sure, a lot of it was simple-minded, but he got into economics and charts and data and deficits, and he mesmerized a lot of middle-class America. The Democratic Leadership Council that Sam Nunn, Chuck Robb, Senator Bob Graham, Al Gore, and Bill Clinton began in 1985 also deserves some credit for repositioning the Democratic Party more towards the center. Not right of center, but more towards the center of where the American people, American voters are. Bill Clinton believes in the death penalty. Bill Clinton believes in a strong defense. Bill Clinton is a pro-business Democrat, as has been witnessed in recent days with response to the bond market, the Silicon Valley business leaders, and so on. He is a different type of Democrat than George McGovern from nearby South Dakota, or Ted Kennedy, or Michael Dukakis, or Walter Mondale from Minnesota. The leaders of the Democratic Party for the last 20 years had moved, with the exception of Jimmy Carter, had moved the party way over to the left, and it was a party increasingly of the minorities and gays and university intellectuals, but not many people in the suburbs, and not many people who are white Southerners, and not many people in small-town America. And as a result, it was suffering defeat after defeat after defeat in the national election years. Only Jimmy Carter won in 1976, and he won because of Watergate. It was the same kind of thing as this year. It was a rejection of Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford and that crowd because of the abuse of power and the scandals of Watergate. It was not an embrace and vote on behalf of Carter or the Democrats. It was the fact that he was there as an alternative at a time when people had disquietude about the eight-year run of Richard Nixon. So the Democratic Leadership Council was also a victor and a factor in the Clinton win. And it's a factor and a compass a little bit that guides him as president. It was a blatant attempt to demcgovernize the Democratic Party, and to some extent it has helped the Democrats appeal to a wider number of constituencies. I'd also say that a word on behalf of Al Gore, who is now being subject to all the vice presidential jokes that come with that institution, and he'll be sacrificed on the late night humor shows endlessly, as all vice presidents get skewered in that same tradition. But Al Gore brought strength to the Democratic ticket. He had run for the American presidency in 1988. He had written a top book on the environment. He had won great respect from his colleagues in the United States Senate, many of whom have told me that they felt that he was the hardest working, brightest member of the United States Senate, which is no small compliment in an institution of huge egos. Time magazine reported a Gallup poll a week or so before the election that if there was a separate election for vice president separate from the presidential ticket, that Al Gore would have received about 66%. These statistics are impressive. It would have been something 66% for Gore. It would have been something like 28% for Vice President Quayle, and it would have been 6 or 7% for an old friend of mine whose name is Admiral Jim Stockdale, who's a wonderful man but who came across rather ineptly on the president-vice presidential debates. Look at those statistics compared to the statistics across the way that I offered earlier on the presidential race. Throughout the campaign, Clinton campaigned with Gore. And throughout the campaign, as opposed to now, time and again he would say the Clinton-Gore program is stressing and running on the coattails, if you will, of Al Gore's popularity. Did George Bush campaign and talk about the Bush-Quayle program in the second term and so on? No. It's out of sight, and he was scheduled in small towns, in small media markets, and low and no media markets around the country. So the Democratic Leadership Council, Perot, and Al Gore all were assets to Clinton in that campaign. Well, how has Clinton done? And Clinton, in my judgment, I would give Clinton a B plus as a campaigner in the campaign of 1992. He deserves perhaps an A for survivability, because the press did get on his case for his marriage, his pot, and particularly draft dodging, and many of the liberal newspapers, Washington Post, L.A. Times, New York Times, were particularly rough on him. A lot of the gaps in what he said, explaining his past and so on. But he survived, and he raised a lot of good issues, and his selection of Gore helped him. And as I said earlier, though, I think Perot was the agenda setter. He was the one who really picked at issues much more sharply than even did Clinton. It was Perot who won the presidential debates. At least two out of the three, and perhaps arguably all three, the American people liked Perot. They listened to Perot, they were entertained by Perot, and they thought Perot was on the money with respect to the issues. Bush came in third. Clinton usually came in a pretty strong second. But it's just one more indication of the way in which Perot helped shape that campaign. Absolutely phenomenal that a person who had never run for office or held office, and not somebody who is kind of a media or television personality, could do so well. Speaking to the American people about tough issues and take on two professional career politicians. People have been in and out of office for 20 years in Clinton and Perot and Bush's case, and do so well. Absolutely fascinating. Imagine if Perot really spent it all. He spent $60 million out of his $3 billion. Here's a guy who could buy not just CBS, but CBS, ABC, and NBC, and a major newspaper in the country. Imagine if he didn't take his summer vacation. Imagine if he didn't get a little goofy and embrace the crazy theme song and some of the other things that he did that kind of... And imagine if he had a strong running mate. Imagine if he had selected Gene Kirkpatrick or some prominent senator, or Paul Songhurst maybe, or Bill Moyers, or whatever. Imagine if he had put together a ticket that somehow resonated and he didn't get out. It could well have been thrown into the House of Representatives, Electoral College, and so on. Well, that's a fun thing to kind of think about. Bill Clinton's transition, in my judgment, was inept. He had 3 months. He stayed in the governorship. He should have got out on day one and given over to his lieutenant governorship and begun appointing people. He's only appointed 10% of the people to his administration, and we're already in the second month of the administration. He's appointed virtually no ambassadors except one to Russia or so, and one to the United Nations. He got a very slow start. I'm not quite sure why. But his economic plan should have been prepared so he could have gone to the nation in week one. Instead of that, the gay ban, the Haitians, the HIV positive issue, and the screw up with respect to appointing an attorney general all overwhelmed him, and the Democrats in the White House looked as though they didn't have their act together and they didn't look as though they prepared. Some of my friends think that we have too long a transition period. Most parliamentary democracies around the world, when you get a vote of no confidence or you lose an election, you're out of there the next day. And the other party, the Labor Party, the Christian Democrats, or whatever, is in office. In our country, we give about 3 months. The election's November 2nd. We swear you in January 20th. Amazing. But Clinton and his people, in my judgment, did not really do half of what they should have done. And they did appoint, ultimately, some good cabinet members. They appointed a lot of women, more women than any president has ever had in his cabinet, if you include Hillary, which I think you should. There are 6 women in the United States presidential cabinet. John Kennedy had 0 women in the United States cabinet. He had 0 women in any position of importance on the White House advisory staff. It is well known these days that he had a lot of women friends. But it is clear that he had no women advisors, no women counselors, no women as cabinet officers. Just 30 years ago. Imagine the difference. We've come considerable distance, and it is positive. I also think that people like Bruce Babbitt at Interior, Henry Cisneros at Housing and Urban Development, Les Aspin at Secretary of Defense are top quality appointments. Several others are promising. There are 3 or 4 I think less of myself. I think his White House staff is more amateur and less strengthened by heavyweights than should be the case. But I think he's beginning to make appointments and move on these. He's been too slow. What about his economic... So his early days in the White House, his first 3 weeks prior to his State of the Union address, I give him a B minus. Since I'm a professor, I give out grades. What the hell? His State of the Union address, I'd give an A minus to. I think it was pretty good. I think it was one of the best in 30 years. It rivaled Reagan at his best, Kennedy at his best. And it was programmatic. The country was upset at George Bush because George Bush would not come up with a program of investing in America and cutting the deficit and so on. The deficit had skyrocketed from, it had doubled in Bush's presidency. And unemployment had gone from 5 to 7.5% and so on. The American people wanted somebody to come and say, we're going to get the economic indicators to go the other way. And that's what Clinton, to his credit, was able to do in an hour-long address to the Congress, interrupted 80 times. The early polls showed that 80% of the American people responded favorably. The bond market has responded extraordinarily favorably. And a lot of the business community has responded saying, yes, this is needed. The taxes will be much complained about and will be hard to get passed by Congress. Essentially, the taxes are being shared mostly by rich people, people over $150,000 income, somewhat by the energy industry and trucking industry and so on, a little bit by well-to-do people who are recipients of Social Security, who will have some of the Social Security income taxed as income as opposed to non-taxed. And there are some other people who hurt a little bit, but basically... the average American will only be asked to pay roughly a dollar a day, roughly $200 to $300 a year, additional taxes. My reaction to his spending cuts, which I think are too low, and his taxes, which are too low, and the politics of his request to the Congress, which is a very feudal, decentralized, interest group, PAC-infested organization, which isn't going to give him much of his program. The history of Bill Clinton and Clinton in Arkansas is he would put programs like this forward. He would then have 2 months, 3 months in which the Little Rock, Arkansas state legislature would tear it apart, delay it, water it down, compromise it, and he would settle for 40, 45% of the package. But ladies and gentlemen, here in Lincoln, Nebraska, if Bill Clinton only gets 40% of his package, it will be more of the same, and it will be the kind of tinkering that we've seen for the past 12 years. And it will be, I think, a big dud. My own view is he should have gone for a package that had 40% more in it. 40% more cuts. I think a lot of his cuts, most of his cuts aren't that bold. Asking to have 100,000 people dropped over a couple-year period from the federal civil service, when we've got a 3 million employee civil service, and we're cutting back the Defense Department by 20% or so over the next 3 or 4 years, that's peanuts. Do you know the figures of those who work in the Defense Department in the United States? We have 2 million in uniform and 1 million civilians. Well, if you cut DOD and our bases overseas and other things by 20%, we're automatically going to lose 100,000 civilians who help to run bases and fleets and so on. And I think it's unacceptable. I think we should have had 200,000 or 300,000 federal jobs mustered out over the next 2 or 3 year period. I also think the Cold War is over. Ross Perot is right. The Cold War is over, and those guys, meaning the Democrats in Congress and the Republicans in the White House and now Clinton, they don't seem to get it. The Cold War is over. We have no major enemy. Not only is the Cold War over, but the Soviet Union and now the Russian Federation is in huge trouble. They can't get together on anything. I've been a consultant recently to the drafters of the Russian Federation's new constitution, and they're in pathetic shape. They've got a legislature that won't talk to Yeltsin. They've got local provinces and regions that don't want to have anything to do with Moscow. They have the Quebec problem for Canada looks mild and tame compared to the constituent parts of the Russian Federation. And Yeltsin's days are numbered. And they are in such bad economic shape that this whole apparatus of protecting against the Cold War and the Soviets is just years and years now past. And I think we can cut the CIA by 25%. Some people have advocated it be abolished. We have a propaganda agency, the United States Information Agency, mega billions and staff all around the world at embassies, Voice of America, propaganda institution. That could be cut in half. The conservatives have suggested that PBS, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, should be abolished because we now have cable television and so on. They have a point. Maybe we should. Sesame Street and so on, maybe they should be moved over to some cable station and so on. Maybe some Ted Turner will come along and be able to commercialize on the successes of Masterpiece Theater and good music and so on. There's so much that can be cut. I think the Education Department can be abolished and merged back with the Housing and Health Services. I think the Veterans Department, which began under Reagan, who was in favor of cutting federal government, could also be merged in with either the Defense Department or the Health and Human Services Department. I think Clinton could have really gone. This is why I think he blew his transition. I don't think he really went after fat in government. I think we could have taxed the wealthy in America another 4 or 5%. And for him to get, this is the important thing, his program has to go through 39 committees of Congress, including Ross Tonkowski's 38-member Ways and Means Committee straight away. They're going to water this thing down. Senator Bennett Johnson, Democrat from Louisiana, doesn't like the energy tax. Guess why? Senator Bobby Byrd from West Virginia doesn't like the spending cuts. Guess why? He's the chairman of the House Appropriation Committee. Moynihan doesn't like some of the Social Security stuff. Senator Nunn from Georgia, these are all Democrats. Forget the Republicans. Senator Nunn of Georgia says, These cuts in the military will make us vulnerable to the world and unable to live up to our national security commitments as a world leader in the New World Order. These are Clinton's buddies. He's going to be done in more by Democrats who are chairman of these key committees. Ross Tinkowski is just about to be indicted, the congressman from Chicago, for misusing campaign funds and office funds and the U.S. Postal Office and Capitol Hill and so on. So Clinton's in for a rough ride. What are the chances of his modest package getting adopted? I put it at something like 54%, maybe 58% on a good day, you know, that the sun's out today. But it's not high. Not high. That's the only program in town. The Republicans don't have a program. Robert Dole would like to freeze programs, and he talks in the abstract about more cuts but doesn't spell it out. Nobody likes to spell out cuts because it gets people on your back and takes money away from your next campaign and brings in bad mail and so on. The average member of Congress has a different lyric to the Fleetwood Mac song that Mr. Clinton loves, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. Their words go, don't stop thinking about re-elections. And that's a driving force that animates their particular. So I think Clinton's in tough shape. I think he should have asked for more and settled for pretty much what he asked. And the failing to do that means that I think he's going to get less. And I think we're going to be in trouble as a nation. We need to save more. We need to invest more. We need a much better education system. We need a much we need a semi-industrial policy with our high-tech industry and the information industry in this country. We need to be much more competitive and sensitive to competing with Europe and the European Economic Market and Pacific Rim nations. Clinton deserves some credit. He has finally got an attorney general who I think will do well. I think it is terrific to have a woman, too, in the inner cabinet, and that is the only inner cabinet position that he's appointed a woman to. I think his town meetings are good. I think his stands on behalf of gays in the military ultimately will be vindicated, although he had to compromise on that, and he should have brought it up later. I think his lifting the gag rule on abortions was the appropriate thing to do. His willingness to sign the Rio Treaty, which Bush was unable to do. I think his signing and encouragement of the Family and Medical Leave Act was positive. I think that his willingness to sign the Brady Bill makes sense and is something the country supports. I think he has had major problems, too. He's backed down on a lot of pledges and programs, and he's going to have to back down on more. Slick Willie, he's called, and there's a restaurant now a few blocks from the White House called Slick Willie that has huge hamburgers and cheeseburgers and all of his kinds of favorite foods in it. He has 47 months to go. Presidents have a tough time leading this country unless it's a honeymoon period, and he hasn't had much of a honeymoon, and he will only have a honeymoon if he can use the bully pulpit to go to the American people, to override interest groups in Congress, and to rally the country to his program. And the jury is out as to whether he will do that. He's skilled. He's had a great 1 week. But one speech in 1 week don't make a presidency. And I think he has a lot of whether his presidency succeeds or not will depend on his Health Care Containment and Reform Act, which will be launched or announced probably in July or June after his wife and his wife's friends finish up on their particular work. Let me conclude by saying two or three things. Clinton is our 42nd president. He won our 52nd presidential election. He has a lot of strengths and qualities. He is part Kennedy, part Reagan, part Jimmy Carter. He loves politics. He loves to campaign. He loves to talk. He has a lot of energy. And now that the little White House jogging track out in the back lawn has developed, maybe he'll lose a few more pounds, like sneaking out at different hours of the day to his own personal, private jogging quarter-mile track. He has enormous problems at home, and yet international problems will not go away. Bosnia, China, Russia, Yugoslavia, Somalia, Iraq, Iran. He was not elected to be a foreign policy leader, but he won't have any choice He can't dictate the kinds of things that descend on the world community and on the United States, and that's going to be a tough thing for him. He has not had much of a track record in that area. His early appointments, not terribly convincing. Warren Christopher is a nice man. Kind of looks like an undertaker to me. And I don't know. He doesn't seem like a man of bold vision to me. And it remains to be seen how good the foreign policy record will be. There are 47 months to go. Let me especially emphasize one thing as I wrap this up. We expect, in many respects, in my judgment, too much from presidents and too little from ourselves. One of the problems in the United States is that too many people think that politics is somebody else's business, that politics is a bad thing, and that politics is for those guys in Washington. Politics, I would try to persuade you, particularly the students here at Nebraska Wesleyan, politics is a good thing, an important thing, a critical thing, a crucial thing. Half of the nations around the world don't allow politics. They don't allow opposition parties. They don't allow dissent. They don't allow protests. They don't allow arguments and contending candidates and parties. Politics is a good thing. Politics is an important thing. And if you didn't have it, you'd want it, you'd cherish it, you'd yearn for it. And I think we need to turn around the negativism towards those who run for office and those who talk politics. Politics is terribly important, and the American people have historically asked too much from a single institution and a single person in the White House. And I leave you with the words of John Steinbeck, the Nobel Prize-winning novelist, who in the 1960s wrote the following paragraph about our attitudes towards American presidents. And I urge those of you who can join us in the talk-back session or discussion session that Professor Vermeer mentioned earlier that shall take place at 11 o'clock to join us. But let me conclude by saying, along with Steinbeck, we give the American president more work than a man can do, more responsibility than a person should take, more pressure than an individual can bear. We abuse him often and rarely praise him. We wear him out, use him up, eat him up. And with all this, nonetheless, Americans have a love for the president that seems to go, a reverence almost for the president that goes beyond nationality or party loyalty. And then he ends up with this following very eerie, compelling phrase. He is ours, and we exercise the right to destroy him. He is ours, and we exercise the right to destroy him. Think about that. Thank you very much.
Today's guest on University Forum has been Dr. Thomas Cronin, author and member of the faculty at Colorado College in Colorado Springs. He delivered the annual Dwight P. Griswold Lecture, Reflections on the Clinton Presidency. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is an independent, coeducational, undergraduate liberal arts institution nationally recognized for excellence in teaching and the high caliber of its students and faculty. Approximately 1,400 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.